And that's the nice bit for us about it is human performance. So, whether you're trying to move a bit of carbon fiber backwards as quickly as possible over 2,000 meters of water, or whether you're sort of trying to create some new product which is going to go to market, or you're sort of looking at keeping an organization financially consistent and safe and legal, it's human performance.
Hi, I'm Oliver Berquez, co-founder of 40 Fit. Welcome to the Brain, Brawn and Business Podcast. The podcast is to get successful people on to talk about what inspires them, what motivates them, the successes and the challenges they faced in business, how they've overcome them, what they've learned along the way. It's a really practical podcast trying to offer real value to the listeners and things you can implement on a daily basis, things around business and strategy and habits, lifestyle, performance. Before I go into the podcast today, just want to let you know about a free private Facebook group that's set up called Brain, Brawn and Business. A lot of mentions and messages from people over the last few weeks since starting the podcast, people getting real value from it. So I decided to set up a group that will be on Facebook, and it's just going to be providing articles, content, stories, advice, mindset, nutrition, lifestyle, habit coaching, various stuff that you can get value from. I'm going to basically cut up various bits from previous podcasts as well, and it's going to be a really educational, informative group. So it's a free private Facebook group. If you're interested, it's Brain, Brawn and Business. You'll be able to find it. All you'll need to do is answer a couple of questions prior to joining, and then just introduce yourself into the group. And like I say, it's going to be a really positive group. So it's Brain, Brawn and Business on Facebook, and the episode coming up now with Chris. Hi, everyone. I'm super excited today to welcome Chris Shambrook on the Brain Business Podcast. Chris has a huge amount of experience in professional sport and in his business world. And today, coming on is going to offer so much value. Chris runs Planet K2 and is in the performance business in terms of athletes and individuals. His accolades, one of the big things is in Olympic sport for 22 years, where he did for the Great Britain rowing team. That's across 5 Olympic cycles, which will be amazing to chat to him about along amongst other things. So, Chris, thanks for coming on.
Absolute pleasure. Great to be here. Thanks for the invite.
Yeah. And anything you'd want to add to the introduction, Chris, what you're doing or what you've done?
But yeah, it's a great introduction, because it kind of tees up us at Planet K2, where, that balance between Olympic sport, professional sport, me as a sports psychologist, helps us go into other environments, such as the business world, where we help people think, prepare and perform like elite athletes. So we've made a business out of helping people understand some of the stuff that athletes and coaches do on a day-to-day basis, and making that accessible for them so that they can pursue, similar levels of excellence in their own field of play. So, that context that has been really important for us, and I've had a great career and still got plenty to go in terms of, stepping into different environments and testing out my knowledge of psychology, but also building a business for us at Planet K2 that keeps adding value using those simple human performance principles. So I guess that's the kind of context for you.
Yeah, fantastic. And this is something which I'm really looking forward to talking about, Chris. And since, looking at stuff you've done, and since we spoke, obviously got introduced to each other 2 or 3 weeks ago, it's fantastic. And like, you're going to be a great guest, and I'm so excited about talking to you today. First thing I want to ask you, though, is just what's your first job after college and uni?
Well, I did my degree, did my PhD, and then went straight into lecturing. But I guess while I was doing my PhD, I was a part-time lab assistant. So I was doing all sorts of stuff, helping with physiological testing, but also sterilizing lab equipment, setting up labs for the physiology lecturers, biomechanics lecturers, doing all sorts of testing of electrical plugs all around the entire university department, and lots of exciting stuff to part fund my PhD.
Fantastic. And that's an interesting thing, people to go to university, because some people aren't supposed to be thinking like that. You're already thinking, right, this is my career. I'm going to probably not, it's when you start uni, you take a little bit of debt or loan to fund it, but actually you're thinking, right, no, I'm almost creating a
getting some money in, doing a job that's an industry that I'm looking to pursue in. So you're learning, getting some money in your degree and helping your degree at the same time. So that's pretty cool.
Yeah, well, it was fortunate that having done the degree, there was, you know, an opportunity to get part-time work and then carry on doing the sort of PhD. And, you know, I was able to help out. It also helped out me, and it also gave me the opportunity to sort of then start being much more around the academic delivery, so the lecturing, you know, the seminars, all of that kind of stuff. So that was helping me get ready to then step into my sort of first career, really, which was, you know, university lecturing, carrying on sort of rather than being the student, started to be the person helping people learn.
Yeah, and that's great. And actually, that's evident stuff I see, the content you share and the way you come across, that you have this real passion to help people. And and it's no surprise in the success you've had in business and what you're doing with Planet K2 and, you know, and stuff. And obviously your performance room, which we can talk about as well. I can see that that's why it's not, you know, it's not coincident.
Absolutely. Well, you know, we're really keen. So Keith, our chief exec, talks about democratizing performance, just being able to give as many people access as possible to the stuff that we know. So the performance room is set up where, you know, most of the content is free. So if people just want to go on there and sort of look around without signing up, they can get that. And then there's a couple of, you know, additional ways that you can get more value from it as well. But most of it is designed to say, hey, look, you know, whatever your level, whatever your standard, whatever your ambition, get on there and there's some useful stuff you can learn.
Yeah, definitely. And, you know, and I think, you know, just going back to the point I mentioned about, you know, I think it's, you know, university and how you had a career, you've obviously it shaped, you sort of moved you forward into a career, what you did at uni, generating, you know, obviously earning some money at the same time and learning lecturing. I think that's really refreshing. So if anyone is listening to this podcast and maybe thinking about, you know, I've got to get into business and how do I do it, I think that's a really good lesson learned right from a young age, that you've taken that on to, you know, get paid in an industry you're looking to pursue, learn, you know, and you know if you did lecturing, so you were the student and then you become the teacher. So yeah, I think it's really important for people starting out.
Yeah, and for me as well, once I got into the lecturing role, I was also starting to pursue applied sports psychology work along the line. So my PhD was in sports psychology. I wanted to be practicing sports psychology. I've got a passion for sport. I've been in, you know, I'd played a lot of different sports and coached sports growing up. That was my chance to start working with people at sort of, you know, in high level sport who are ambitious and better at doing the sport than I was, but I could probably help them think about it more effectively. But that allowed me to then start getting some sports site work alongside my lecturing work. And then eventually I was able to sort of move out of lecturing because there was sufficient capacity for me to be working as a practitioner. So rather than being a lecturer, I'd had the opportunity to get a couple of contracts, start working with coaches and athletes and sports. And that was when I was able to kind of move away from lecturing and then more move into the kind of, you know, running my own business. And then being fortunate enough in 2003 to sort of meet Keith, our CEO, and, you know, then become part of Planet K2 as well.
Yeah, fantastic. And, you know, so I think something which is really... industry, because what's really important here is that, you know, you went to University of Brighton and yep. You went there, then you lectured there, didn't you, obviously, as you said, and then obviously you've gone on, is it University of Gloucester, I think it's Gloucestershire, did you go there as a lecturer?
Yes,
and stuff?
Yeah, I did.
You know, this is what really I find really inspiring, and actually it can be lost a little bit now, is that you've got clear direction on where you wanted to go. You're working out what things are going to take you to where you want to get to. You know, you've done your degree, you're now lecturing, it's moving on to lecturing, it's passion in sport, you're rubbing shoulders with the right people. So all of these things are leading you into, which we'll come on to, definitely talking about the Olympic sport and what you did there with GB, Team GB. So what advice would you give to people starting that industry? Because that's an amazing path to follow. I mean, do they need to go to uni or how does it work? Because it's fascinating what you've done.
Yeah, so I think what it is, if you kind of know the direction that you're going, you will start to... surround yourself with people who are perhaps a little bit further along the path as well already, and being able to sort of be inspired by them, take advice from them, but also collaborate with them is a great way of then sort of getting your foot on the ladder yourself as well. So Steve Ball, my PhD supervisor, you know, Bully was a great influence for me. He was working with the England cricket team, the women's England cricket team, while I was doing my degree and PhD. He ended up working with the full test team as well, both in the men's and women's game. So, you know, Steve was a great applied practitioner. That helped me a lot. I was able to sort of have someone to sort of learn from and also aspire to sort of, you know, do as well as they were doing and be equally as successful. So I think for me, it's that case of, you know, understand that other people are going to be important for your journey, even though, even as much as you'd want to do it on your own. It's one of the key things I've learned with the successful athletes and business people as well, is that the people who are best at making the most of the generosity, knowledge, skill and experience around them will also, you know, tend to be in a position to pass that on themselves in years to come. So I'd say, you know, look for the people who are going to be your good allies along the way.
Yeah, definitely. And I think that this is something I find really, it's been great since launching the podcast, chatting to business owners, you know, people in successful positions actually are really willing to help, and they like sharing their story, and they you know, and it's amazing. So I think that's so true. So what you're saying to people is, you know, see what industry you want to go in, where do you want to get to, and find people who are successful in that industry that you can maybe learn from and be around.
Definitely. And you know, if you are fortunate enough to get alongside them, you know, and work with them as well, that's great. But I do think people are increasingly approachable with the right approach these days. It isn't just a case of, you know, just a sort of an email or a contact out the blue or a tweet or something on Instagram. But it's more a case of, you know, create a value proposition for yourself and be really clear what it is you'd like and why you'd like it and how that would be helpful and why particularly want to sort of learn from a specific individual. You know, there's so much communication available. You've got to try and do something that does, you know, show you in the communication as, you know, being part of the offer and part of the request. You know, it's get the human side of it across rather than, you know, just being another bit of electronic mail that's received.
Yeah, of course. And then, so advice to get someone starting in the industry or starting in business, you're saying obviously connect with, learn from people who are in the position you want to get to. Is there any other advice you give to people starting out in your industry or in business?
Well, so, you know, yeah, from Planet K2 perspective, and you know, we've worked in education all the way through to different, you know, dozens of different sectors. We focus on helping people get ready to perform. And you know, going back to University of Brighton a few years ago, I was kind of talking to the graduating students about, you know, well, this is what we do with the sports science concepts you've learned. This is about how does someone get ready to be as confident and as effective as possible in any performance environment, whether that's work, whether that's the arts, whether that's sport. Just really do the groundwork like athletes do. They have to get really great at doing the basic skills and having the basic knowledge. They have to have the basic tactical know-how. They know they're going to do the hard yards. They're going to keep doing the physical training. They're going to keep doing the mental training. You know, I'd see advice for anyone, you know, are you training like you're serious? And that you're serious, you want to be good and excelling and performing at the level that you want to. So, it, you know, for me, it's all about that readiness, preparation, do the groundwork, and then you provide a foundation upon which additional skill, expertise, knowledge, experience gets built as well. So, you know, prepare like an athlete, do the basics, get fit for purpose, and that, but no, that's just the entry level stuff.
Yeah, yeah, fantastic. That's great. And then, so with sort of physical and mental training, what type of stuff can you share? What type of things do you do for your physical health? And then also what type of things you do for your mental health or anything that you could, little tips or tricks you maybe share with the listeners?
I think personally, you know, I'm never one who's really been amazing at sticking to routines and having consistent habits. So I'm always looking for stuff that's going to keep me interested in trying to achieve what I want to achieve. So I've, you know, so at the moment I'm using an app on my phone, which is Runtastic. So Adidas have just bought that and relabeled that. But that's an app which is bodyweight exercises, which because I travel around a lot, I can be doing sort of, you know, 15 to 25 minute workouts 3 to 5 times a week, yeah, wherever I am. Doesn't need any equipment, and it's there. Doesn't cost a huge amount, but it's like having a personal trainer with you. Really good stuff. So I'm doing that just to sort of keep in shape and look after myself, and that's been really, really helpful physically. So in the past, I've been part of the middle-aged cycling brigade and sort of getting into the lycra. I've been doing that as well. So running from time to time. But I kind of start things and then see how long they run for, in the knowledge that, you know, if they last for a long time for me, that's great. And if they go, then I'll find something else. So that's been really helpful recently from the physical side. Mental health side, you know, there's just so many more options now in terms of meditation. So I've been experimenting much more clearly with meditation over the last 12 months, sort of doing a daily evening meditation, using again an app that allows you to do that. Being a psychology professional over the years, I've been pretty good at applying a lot of the stuff to myself anyway, but actually having a daily habit of the meditation has been interesting and added, you know, some useful stuff to, you know, just some, at the end of the day, having a set period of time where I know I'm just going to tune into something different, listen to some words, and just systematically relax.
Yeah, so important. So like meditation, what app do you use, out of curiosity?
I use Insight Timer, which has got thousands and thousands of free meditations on it of all sorts of different types. It's really good. I've used Headspace in the past with the Olympic athletes, and I know Budify as well is pretty good.
Yeah, that's the other two. I haven't actually heard of Insight Timers. That's great. So anyone listening, because meditation is becoming more and more important nowadays for people, you know, and it's really good, because I think what's relevant here is, and you know, sometimes meditation, you know, becomes a bit in, a bit hip. So people try meditation and actually... which I can see sometimes in the gym, or in my world, I see sometimes as well, Chris, where if it's a bit popular, people try it. But what people lose sight of is actually, why are you actually doing that, and how is it helping you? And rather than just because social media said that actually meditation can be cool, you know, I don't know if you find that can be lost a little bit. But what's great here is, I think what's really important, anyone listening, is actually using meditation for someone in the work that you're doing, and how you find the value of meditation to for your own personal well-being, which ultimately I'm assuming you're going to sleep better if you're doing it evening. In the morning, it's firing you up for the day, and then you're leading into being able to service your clients effectively.
Yeah, so there's some other bits we do at work which sort of from the morning point of view help, and I'll mention them later. But certainly, you know, the important thing that I find with this is that increasingly we want to see sort of mindfulness or meditation as a whole body thing. And you know, so just think about your overall physical routine and mental routine, but just then think about your personal routine or personal habits. If we separate physical and mental, we actually lose some of that, because, you know, there's some really great stuff when you're doing some workouts where if you're focusing and being mindful on the movements, you're actually going to do them more effectively, and you are more, you know, you're using that workout time more effectively. So rather than separating mind and body, you end up sort of putting the two together. And so, having worked with the elite athletes, you know, that's something where, sure, we work on things separately, but ultimately it's a test of mind and body together.
Yeah.
You know, you saw Dina Asher Smith stepping up and running a brilliant race last night, finishing second in the 100 meter world championships. Yep, you know, she could easily have lost it when, you know, she realized pretty early on she wasn't going to get the gold. But actually, she's so great at tuning into what she does mentally whilst being physically absolutely on the money. You just see a person performing at the peak. You don't see mental excellence. You don't see physical excellence. You just see human performance excellence combined.
Yeah, definitely. 100%. Really good points. So can I just ask, what's been your biggest business successes today, Chris?
Well, regularly at Planet K2, we kind of look at some of the customers, the great people that we've had the opportunity to work with, and you know, and actually being able to go and work with household name organizations across many different sectors, and being able to do that over the 16 years that the business has been going, I'd put down that down as an ongoing biggest success, if you like. It's kind of, you know, we always strive to be better, but we're always delighted with who we're getting to work with and the work that we get to do. So I think creating an organization that has delivered so much value consistently across so many different sectors, that for me is the biggest success. And having, for me, being at the heart of that in terms of what's the philosophy and the theory and what do we choose to provide, that's kind of all wrapped up in that biggest success.
Yeah, and that's brilliant words. And I think, you know, credit to, you know, you don't just do that work if you're not good at what you're doing and you're not ever evolving and, you know, so, you know, and you know, applying your craft and all the little bits you've done and the years of experience you've gained to get there. So, yeah, and it's an interesting answer, actually, because people will highlight one or two business successes. But from your perspective, it's almost like all of the work you've done to develop yourself is allowing you to constantly have these business successes and continue to grow.
Yeah, and see what we can do next, or see how well we can sustain. And yeah, and maybe it's having been involved in an endurance sport for, you know, 22 years has kind of just got me into that sense that, you know, keeping going is probably the most important, you know, one of the most valuable things, and sustaining excellence is, you know, really key. And but that definitely for us is very, very important, because it would be completely wrong of us to do what we do and then have, you know, sort of lots of you know, high levels of sizzle but quickly fade out stuff. You know, we talk about enduring success through understanding your performance recipe and your ingredients and building them and, you know, being curious about how to keep going. If we weren't doing this stuff ourselves, I don't think we'd be able to help people as authentically as we do.
No, definitely. So can I ask, how have you stayed successful, you know, all these years, and you continue to be successful? Like, use Planet K2 as an example. You've just said the household names you work with, and that you're continuing to work with them at businesses. So how have you stayed successful for so long?
So I think there's been a couple of things. So certainly Keith, who heads up our business, Keith is great at sort of, you know, taking himself off and sort of thinking ahead of the curve and just sort of determining what are we going to do next, or how are we going to sort of create some more value that builds on top of what we've got. So he's excellent at doing that, which kind of keeps us fresh and focused. But also we've been incredibly good at staying focused on some core principles of success. So I think, you know, when Keith started the business up in 2003, there was some really simple stuff on performance and performance readiness and motivation. We've been incredibly good at sticking to those core ingredients, but learning how to make them relevant as conditions and the environment changes around us and the businesses that we work with. So we haven't chopped and changed. We've had a kind of a core to what we do, but then we've been ever more skillful at helping make that relevant and practical for people, whilst then adding on other bits that do add value rather than just seem the latest shiny gadget that we might be able to put in front of people.
Yeah, so you're saying you've got your core business, your core, you know, ethos, which runs through the business, and then from that, that's like the bread and butter stuff almost, and then there's little spin-offs or other little areas you'll go off from that as you've obviously moved forward with different, you know, with clients to and stuff.
Yeah, I always say there's less to us than meets the eye, you know.
But less is more though, Chris, isn't it though? Isn't that sometimes good? You know, we can overcomplicate and do, you know, because ultimately, and this is what I want to talk about as well, is the success you've seen. So what you've done for GB, yeah, and all those years of success. And it's like, you know, people aren't successful in sport, and you haven't seen any success because you've just changed something every week. You know, you have to be consistent. There has to be, there's these consistent behaviors and habits that you have done over a period of time, which fall in line with your ethos to allow you to continue to develop. So there is that, you know, that sort of consistency that's needed, isn't it? Which you've seen at the top level of sport, and that is evident in you and what you're doing with Planet K2, and how that's evolved.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I say regularly that having had the privilege of working with amazing coaches, amazing athletes, that, you know, the coaches have a really high boredom threshold, because, you know, the rowing stroke doesn't get reinvented every week. You know, there's core principles, and the coaches are amazing at sticking with the discipline and the philosophy that they believe is going to work. And equally, the athletes are incredibly good at challenging themselves to be marginally better at something that they're already world class at every single day, and that kind of whole philosophy is critical. And typically, so you know, for anyone listening, you've earned the right to be very skillful and good at something that you already do. Never lose sight of what it is that you've done to earn the right to be there, and keep practicing and refining those things, as well as looking for some of the sort of stuff that keeps it fresh and exciting, where there might be a breakthrough.
Yeah, definitely. I'll come on to mindset later, actually. We will delve into some people think, oh, come on, I want to talk about GB Olympic sport and stuff. But we'll get there. So with this success you've had, obviously it's an ongoing success, and I love hearing that, and I think it's so great. You know, for me, if you can be in an industry for a long period of time, it shows you're doing something right. It shows credibility. It builds your kudos, your credentials, what you're doing. And actually, in the fitness, the performance, this type of industry, to be around it for so long is great. You know, and I think that's fantastic. But with that, there's obviously challenges and, you know, and mistakes or things. So what biggest challenges have you had, or things, mistakes you've made that you've learned from that you could share?
So if I think of the rowing role, you know, that was 22 years of me as the kind of psychology practitioner, providing, you know, the advice, the support for the team, you know, on a 60-day-a-year contract. So I was kind of not fully embedded, which in some ways had strengths, but in some ways meant that, you know, you were always trying to sell yourself and trying to sell the service. So, you know, that was always a challenge, you know, managing the time that I had available to the impact that would be desirable. But again, it's also being realistic. So, you know, I think the biggest challenges always came from being a slight outsider who's an insider. So that, you know, I would have made mistakes whereby I'd misread a situation that was being handled, but because I wasn't on the ground, I wasn't inside it as much as I should be. So I tried to advance things when actually I'd have been better off, I'd have been better off asking more questions rather than trying to provide solutions. And I think, you know, typically, it's where I've stepped into solution providing mode rather than question asking mode is where the biggest mistakes and the biggest challenges have come. So, you know, take the time to do the due diligence. Don't just jump to conclusions. Don't, you know, trust your instant reaction. Keep asking the questions and sort of, you know, talk to the coach, talk to the athlete, talk to the crew, make sure what's going on, so that you end up adding value rather than perhaps causing more interference than would have been necessary. So that's always been, those have been the situations where, you know, it's been try to act too quickly and cut into solution, trying to make a difference, trying to earn your keep rather than do it earn the keep in a different way.
Yeah, and that's such great advice. And so can I ask then, obviously you said 60 days and you were, obviously had this role and you weren't maybe on the ground as much with that. So because did that make you, did you feel you almost had to show your worth because you weren't there as much to try and be almost get the solution and be the one to be seen, or were you not? Was that not the case?
Potentially. So there were different pockets, some areas where you kind of, you're on the ground and you're running and you're embedded and you know, you're, it's been worked out how, where to focus my psychological expertise, and other areas you're trying to sell yourself a bit more. And you know, so I think that, you know, that you've got a squad, to the Olympic squad maximum is 49 athletes, I think, with, you know, where you're looking at sort of 10-12 coaches, another sort of half a dozen support staff, so you've got a pretty big group of people. So it wasn't the same level of engagement across the entire squad.
Yeah.
So, you know, where you kind of, where you've got your fit, your champions are working for you, you've got good collaboration, that was good. And so much more confidence and consistency. But there's other areas where you're trying to, you know, get credibility, gain credibility, sort of add some value as well. So that was always just, you know, the challenge, managing the differentiated relationships that I had with different coaches, different squads as well. So that meant enjoy the upside and then be equally frustrated that I'm not making as much impact as I'd like to. So, you know, trying to balance the two all the time for a net positive.
Of course. And has that helped you now in business that you've, because what I mean, so it's interesting. I use terminology painting pictures, something which we have a lot of clients here. So what we'll do, and this is, you know, I've learned over years now, but we'll sit down with clients and I might know what the solution may be from their lifestyle change or nutritional perspective for them, but I won't paint their pictures. You know, they have a picture in their mind. So almost You've got to be, like you said, not solution-based here. Ask questions, you know, find out what works for them, but let them decide on the actions that they need. And a lot of questioning goes on with clients here, and something I've learned to do. So, you know, do you feel that's obviously now really important? Is that helping you in your doing your business now?
Yeah, enormously. So, you know, when we are sort of working with some of the sort of organizations that we work with, and they're asking us about creating a coaching culture,
yep.
You know, let's get our leaders coaching people and developing them. Yep. You know, a lot of the conversations we have are, okay, well, within the coaching culture, make sure you are having the conversations about it's a collaboration. So it is coach and performer.
Yeah.
Give performers the opportunity to sort of say, this is the kind of coaching that I value. Rather than just having coaches who have been trained in a certain way and they only coach a certain way. Because you know, I definitely know that there are people who don't want you sitting there asking questions and being reflective. They would like to have an expert who's saying, look, I've seen this a lot of times before. If you're up for this, I can give you some direction. Let's try a couple of things and we'll get going. And there's other people who would definitely like you to sort of ask the questions and do much more of that kind of rapport building, making it much more of a joint ownership piece as well. So that would be the bit I'd say. Trust yourself to establish how we're going to work together from the outset. Do you want me to be more solution focused, or do you want us to be more collaborative and we work out how this goes together? And you just find things move forward much more quickly when it's a collaboration like that.
Yeah, totally. So managing expectations at the start, which is probably pretty much like any relationship, isn't it?
Yes.
You know? Yeah.
Yeah.
No, it's great. Great to hear you say that. And I think that's really important. Anyone sort of listening to that. And, you know, certainly, because I think, you know, with clients, it's stuff, you know, it's that guide and discovery a little bit, you know, have the conversation. If people come up with the answers themselves, they're going to take ownership of it. You must see it in the workplace now. You know, if you're getting the leaders of a workplace that you're in, if they're coaching, developing their staff, it might be your framework, but it's their ideas. And if they're involving the staff in the decision making, then the staff are a bit better because, again, it's their ideas. They take ownership of it. Do you find that?
Yeah, that goes back to classic motivation theory and the difference between intrinsic and extrinsic motivation. And if intrinsically, if you've sort of generated something yourself, you are going to have greater connection with it. You will persevere with it for longer because you've got that sense that you created it. So absolutely. And we use in all our work self-determination theory by Ed Deci and Richard Ryan, which is great, you know, really simple theory that says if people feel in control or they've got choice and autonomy, motivation levels are higher. If they're feeling confident that they've got the capacity and the desire to do what's required, motivation levels are higher. And if they're connected and they feel that they're part of working towards something with other people, motivation levels are higher. So what you've just said there fits the bill perfectly, doesn't it? You know, people who had choice, they've been given confidence and it's together, you know, easy win. Contrast that with when you feel that you've been told what to do, you're not sure you've got what it takes, and you feel on your own. You know, not a huge amount of motivational quality there typically.
Yeah, definitely. Nice, great stuff mentioned. So moving on to sort of daily habits, I know you said earlier in the early in the chat about, you know, you're not too routine because, like, in terms of your training, because, you know, you've got the app, you like to do your own workouts, and once that changes, yeah, you move on. Do you have daily habits that are quite consistent for you? Also, lean into that. Do you have like a morning routine, an evening routine? You mentioned meditation that you follow that helps you, that you can share with the listeners.
Yeah, so I completely sort of switch off every time I see on LinkedIn 23 things that amazing people do before breakfast, because I just think it's you know, it's just trying to copy recipes that aren't personal. So yeah. So there's a lot of challenges in that. But so routine wise, my diary isn't very consistent. So I just have sort of things that I seek to do when I can. So the exercise stuff, definitely. Meditation has been useful over the past 12 months or so. As a business, every morning we kind of do a check-in where we, you know, we five questions that we ask: how are you feeling as the day starts? What are your intentions for today? What do you need to do to get ready? Which of our values are you going to use? And what support do you need? And so I've instigated that in the business, one, to help me, because that helps me tune in. And then two, that is also us living some of those good habits. And we've found that really useful, where it's kind of a collective check-in virtually that we do.
That's
been really helpful. And also, so again, it's not necessarily routine as in every day, but if I'm going and doing a coaching session or I'm presenting, I will share, and the other coaches in the business share, what are our delivery intentions for the day. How are we going to be? What's our mindset? What are we looking to achieve? And how are we defining success for us?
Yeah.
And then when we finish the day, we then just do a quick wrap up of how well we think we did what we set out to do. We give ourselves a score. And so we do lots of collective stuff. So, and personally, I find that sort of really useful because there's more of an accountability around it.
100%. And I love that. And I think, you know, that accountability is so important, and it goes back to the team environment, how team's so important.
Yeah.
And actually, you know what? I think that from a performance perspective, and something which is really important to myself is self analysis, you know, reviewing your own performance, reviewing what your day's gone. You know, I journal a lot. So for me, I will look at areas to improve, what didn't go well, what did go well, even reviewing every meeting, every conversation, every interaction, how I could have done better. Could I have impacted the person I spoke to better? So all of these things. And I found that it's probably been the biggest growth in performance for me. So hearing you say that's amazing. Mm. And actually, it far outweighs daily habits, morning routine, the collaboration, and actually the focus on asking those questions. Goes back to the questions, I suppose, Chris, which we talk about with clients and employees and staff. Because the answers from that, it shapes your performance. It shapes your next steps. It shapes what's happening in the business.
Yeah. And, you know, so for me as well, having worked in that Olympic environment, you don't want athletes who are just great at reflection. What you do want is you want athletes who state what they're going to do with confidence, so the intent is laid out, and they're then curious and committed to find out how well they can make that intention come to life. And therefore, the reflection is about how well did I actually do what I said I was going to do. So it's that feed forward cycle, which allows you to sort of build on your strengths and really, you know that you've earned the right to be testing yourself out here. With sometimes, if it's just about reflection, you can keep looking for stuff which isn't right or isn't good or could be better. But that's very different, you know. And you know, think back to you playing football. You know, look, I see lots of football players in post-match interviews. They'll tell a story about what happened, which really, you know, when you think about all the work that goes on the training ground and the game plan that's put in place, I want to know, how well did you execute the game plan? How well did you do what you've been practicing all week? I don't really care that the referee made a terrible decision or this happened. I want to know, how well did you bring the game plan to life? And then how do you build on that confidence of doing what you say you're going to do to go again next week? Because that's the thing that makes the biggest difference.
Yeah. Brilliant. And so do you think, Chris, sort of this self-reflection, self-analysis, this reflection within a team environment of each other and making each other accountable, would you say they're almost like the top daily habit or whatever you want to call it? They're almost like such top principles that anyone can apply, because I that's, you know, how I'm seeing it.
Yeah, particularly as well if there is that kind of shared goal that's already in place.
Yeah.
You know, so why are we a team in the first place? What are we looking to achieve? What's important to all of us? And then let's have all of those conversations about personally what I want to contribute and how I want to make a difference in relation to that shared objective, because then we get that kind of connectedness and that collaboration at a higher level. So I think where you can, that's a really great opportunity to do that. And the equivalent of that, if you're not in a team, well, who's your support team around you? You know, so who are the other people that you could share that with and say, hey, look, you're important to helping me get to where I want to go to. It'll be great to be checking in, you know, so that we can be talking about what I'm doing, what I'm trying to do, and how you can make a difference to me. And I can share with you some of the successes and some of the sort of concerns, and we can, you know, I can get that support from people challenging and supporting me rather than having a team bit, which not everyone has.
Yeah, definitely. You know, totally, 100%. It's great advice there, Chris. So you spoke about exercise helping you. Do you do any other recreational activities that help you away from your work? Is there anything you do to relax away from work, or is it, you know, physical activity? And obviously you mentioned meditation and your body weight stuff you do.
Yeah, so that, you know, that certainly helps, and that gives me sort of pretty decent downtime. You know, I live in the Cotswolds, and
beautiful.
So that's a cool place to live.
Lovely,
so
yeah.
Walking a dog, it doesn't take long to get out on the hill and sort of getting out in and amongst sort of nature and just sort of getting out in the fresh air. And there's some fairly hefty hills to get up So I, you know, that when that can be done is great, and that adds in a lot of stuff, you know. But also with a 15-year-old and a 6-year-old, if you know, I'm not taking one in the car to play netball, I'm sort of taking the other one somewhere else to do something and sort of playing child sort of relay with my wife. So that stuff keeps us busy too,
of course. But I'm sure it's a passion, it's something that you love anyway, so seeing them do their sports or whatever.
Absolutely. We'll certainly see it. You know, my daughter's just started sort of, you know, really pushing on with her netball, and she's enjoying that as well. I'm not quite sure where she wants to take it, but I just keep encouraging her to sort of enjoy it while she can, and, you know, sort of be curious about, you know, what happens with it. So, great seeing that.
Yeah, so this is an interesting one. And because obviously the nature of yourself, Chris, and what you've done in terms of sport and in business, which I think maybe different to some of my previous guests, I have a 3- and 6-year-old, obviously football in my background. Mm-hmm. My 3-year-old loves kicking a ball around and stuff. And I was like, oh, you're going to be a good footballer because, you know, you play football and all that. So, well, I don't know. Before I share my thoughts on it, I'd be interested to get your thoughts because, look, you've been and seen it and done it in the sport. So what do you do, the advice you get to your 15 and your 6-year-old? Obviously, you mentioned you just sort of encourage you to keep enjoying it and stuff. But is there anything you give your children advice because you've been there and seen it, done it, or not advice? I'd be loved to know. It'd be good, interesting.
Well,
to
yeah, we're... Yeah, with the teenager, obviously, I'm genetically sort of related, so any advice is null and void. So that becomes harder.
Of course,
harder.
Yes.
You know, try and be helpful. Try and, you know, you try and add, you know, give useful advice and perspective. But with both of them, certainly, you know, and so Carol Dweck's growth mindset is really popular and has been popularized. Yeah. So for years, I've just sort of taken the very basics of that. And so, you know, so that, and that boils down to be good, try hard and have fun. And if you can go to school or go to your sport and, you know, try hard, have fun and be a good person while you're doing it, that's a pretty solid foundation, which sort of gets into, you know, the right kind of attributional stuff. So, you know, I can always try hard, I can always choose to be good, and actually if the fun's there as well, then that's great. So, you know, I've always used that as some basic pointers, and then, you know, just being ready to be supportive.
Yeah.
And if asked the question and I can provide some advice, then you know, then I will do.
No, it's really good. It's challenging, like you said, if you're 15-year-old, you know, for dad offering advice, even if you've seen it, been it, seen it, done it, it's very, very challenging.
Trust me, this stuff works. Not for me, Dad.
Yeah, exactly, Chris, exactly. But yeah, it's a really good you know, really, really good stuff. Yeah, I say to my daughter, we say, you know, be kind, you know, have courage, never give up. It's always like 3 things we say to her, and then she goes, "Daddy, I want to be kind. I'm gonna, have courage. I'm never gonna give up."
Yeah.
Perfect. That'd do for us.
Absolutely.
And then,
yeah, great stuff.
You know, we go. So going on to the second part of the podcast, Chris. Now I want to get into GB rowing and the psychology role you had there, and find out a bit more about it, because I think what's great about obviously your journey and where you are now at Planet K2 is probably what you've seen through the 20 odd years and the 5 Olympic cycles with Great British Rowing, and obviously the great athletes that you've met. I'm sure there's been, you know, some great learning experiences. So I'd love to talk to you about that now. And so the first thing I'd love to know is, what changes you saw through the Olympic cycle? So your first one was after...
After Atlanta. So I had 97 I started. So it was, leading up to Sydney.
So Sydney 2000. So what was it like starting with Great British Rowing when you first went?
At the age that I was at the time and sort of first job in Olympic sport with the likes of Steve Redgrave, Matthew Pinson, Jürgen Grobler, their coach, you know, actually pretty exciting, but equally intimidating at the same time to sort of come in and seek to be adding value and you know, obviously the rowing team had been the only gold medal for the entire Team GB at the 1996 Olympics, with Stephen Matthew getting that gold medal and sort of joining with Steve on the hunt for his fifth Olympic gold medal, and also the women's program starting to come up. So Mike Spracklin was there, who was Steve's coach many years before, who I think had worked with Steve when he won certainly his first or one of his first Olympic medals. So, you know, Mike, an incredibly experienced coach. So I had a pretty quick learning, to be honest, and I had to work out quite quickly how to move into the space of seeking to deliver value with some people who were already very good at what they did, very confident in what they were able to do. But also, as with all these programs, new athletes coming in, going into their first Olympic cycle. And so there was a great opportunity for me to start on a journey with those people too, you know, fresh slate with those guys, as well as the chance to learn with and from some of the senior ones as well. So yeah, just a great hotbed of learning for me, really, and a chance to check out if I could use some of the psychology principles on myself to be as confident I was telling those people I could help them become.
Yeah, because that's ultimately like it, isn't it? Because it's that, and this is a fascinating thing of life, is, you know, when you're going into a situation like that, and someone's had such an amazing achievement in something, where you're coming in unknown, as it were, you've done your graft, because to be recognised, to get the opportunity, you've done something great with your bosses or whoever brought you into that, into the fold. But coming into it, you're still very young, and you've got these people with huge accolades to it. So it's like a daunting, it must be daunting. And and then it's like, right, so I've got to now stamp my authority. I've got to go into it. So for example, like with Steve, who's had so much achievement, did you, and someone like Matthew Pinson and that, would you do too much with them? I mean, is it, could you, or is it
to be honest, I wanted to pick their brains. That was the tactic I wanted to go in there with. I wasn't going to seek to add value. I wanted to very much sort of find out what was already working for them. I was sort of curious and sort of seeing how I might be able to sort of, you know, almost code some of that and share it with other people in a way that might work for them. So very much, I'd love to find out what's been at the heart of your success, you know, rather than sort of thinking that I might be able to come up with something they haven't thought about already. They've done a few things by then. So that was very much the approach. But then also,
and were they willing to?
Yeah, yeah.
Just to add, were they willing to share that when you asked them?
Yeah, you know, so, I think you know, you can talk to a lot of the people that, you know, once you gain a little bit of the trust and you sort of, you know, get a sense of credibility, that there might be some, you know, something that you've got to offer as a person in terms of sort of spirit and character. I think very, very willing to learn, and also just to make sure that I was clear with them that, you know, I'm not seeking to do anything and try anything, because I know you've done a lot of stuff before. You work very closely with your coach, but they were willing to share. And interestingly as well, I think after the first World Championships, where I sort of observed them going and performing, what was really clear to me was just how very switched on they were, really laser focused all the way through competition up to the final. But as soon as they switched off, and they'd finished racing, actually much more open, you know, really chilled, and you could see the switch between the performer mindset and then back to the person. So actually just a good opportunity to see them and chat a little bit more when the pressure was off.
Yeah, and that must be great. And actually now, when you're dealing with companies in your role that you're doing now, that must help you be able to sort of pass that on to them, you know, in terms of that, look, you know, right, here's something really, you know, we've got to deal with something here within a corporate environment. You know, everyone gets their A game on, but there is that relaxation, that downtime, that release in whatever capacity. Are you finding that now with your work?
So with a lot of the work that we do, I guess we're trying to help people deal and live in an environment where they're competing pretty much all the time. It's great working in, working with the athletes, they train much more than they compete. So, you're competing based upon how effectively you can train and move yourself on, so that next time you do go and do one of your 20 races a year, you're in better shape. So it's a very different world. So I guess we're in the corporate world, one, trying to create a little bit more of that contrast for people to be able to, you know, you are competing all the time, but how do you create some of that pause, relaxation, give yourself the
well, this is what I was going to say, because you can't, because you can't just keep going. It, you know, it, obviously certain people possibly can, but you do need to channel it or find a way. So it's great you're saying that.
Yeah, and, you know, I think what's important to look at there is that there's a chance for people to think about, you know, some of the principles from, you know, fitness training, to be honest, frequency, intensity and duration of the, you know, activity. If you want to get fit, if you want to develop your physiological systems in a certain way, you vary how frequently you exercise, what the intensity is that you do and how long the sessions last for. And if you start playing around with those variables at work as well, you can start thinking about, right, which are the things that I need to be where it's really frequent, there's high intensity, but they don't last too long. But, you know, and how do I get myself ready for those? What's the stuff that's infrequent but high intensity and long duration? So you can start looking at how does your diary stack up in terms of the workload, and then start looking at when am I relaxing because the frequency and the intensity of stuff has gone off. So I've got active recovery taking place. So there's a lot just starting to look at, you know, what's the accumulated load that you've got? What have you got to be ready for? And how can you bring in some contrast when you have got different kinds of things that you're doing that don't all need to be 100% eyeballs out all the time, you know, for as long as you can. It's creating some shifts and some contrast for yourself.
Yeah. And also, do you look at people's day in terms of their flow? So what I mean by that is, you know, to avoid decision fatigue, I don't know if you get this, and something that I get and I've had to look at is there's times in a day when I'm more productive, mm-hmm. and I know my mind's focused, so I know how that works for me. For me, it's the morning. Then there's times where it's, you know, a little bit of decision fatigue may sit in and I need to adjust the tasks I do. And there's other times then when I can focus on, I'm very where the energy's really high, mm-hmm. so I might go and really do on some development work. Are you looking at peaks and flows through the day, or you're not so much
well,
that?
Yeah, well, holistic, you know, we talk to people about being ready to perform and looking at all the variables that come into play there as well. So we will talk to people about, you know, their sort of natural, sort of whether they're a lark or an owl kind of morning person where the energy's high and you know, then, you know, they can really have all of their sort of focus and look to do great stuff then, or whether they're an owl and sort of coming alive a little bit later in the day and into the evening. One, to raise awareness, but two, to see if you can put tasks where your sweet spot of energy is, do so. But if you can't, be aware of where you might need to bring in some other tactics to help you sort of manage the fact that your natural energy isn't going to be as high as well. So, you know, we get that in sport a lot where people are playing, they're performing at a time of day they wouldn't choose to, but, well, you know, hard luck, you've got to go and do it anyway. So how good can you be when it isn't your ideal, and how do you compensate for that in terms of how you fuel or how you focus, the support you get around you, being extra concentrated, being more meticulous. You know, there's stuff you can do, but it's just looking at when can you take control and put stuff in your favour, and if you can't, how confident are you that you can still bring a pretty good game close to your A game?
Yeah, no, it's great. And I think, so, you know, I have business owners and I listen to this and stuff, and it's, I suppose, really, it's not just 9 to 5. We have phones now and we can communicate. We can do stuff at any time of the day. So I suppose, you know, for business owners listening to this, is they have to be a little bit flexible. You find that, you know, with these big companies you work with, they have to have some flexibility, the bosses, to be able to, you know, get their playing the right positions, doing the right jobs at the right times.
There's also making sure that you're really clear about the choices that you make. You know, what are the hours that I am willing to work and that work for me, and being really clear about those choices. So you don't necessarily just fall straight into a, you know, always on mindset. So I think if you're really clear about that, that helps a great deal. I think as well, it fits in with some of the stuff we talk about. And on the performance room, there's one of the performance fixes, which is, you know, work-life balance isn't a very helpful concept. Think about how good are you at developing energy for the stuff that's important to you in your life. So have you got the energy for the stuff that you like doing, that you want to do, that you find rewarding? And for some, you know, for everyone, something that's important to them pretty much is their work. So, you know, how do you get the energy for that? How do you keep the energy high? But how do you make sure that that energy is then still going to be up and high for the other stuff when you, you know, when you're not in work, family, social life, sport, you know, all of that stuff. So I think if people look at that and you look at it over, you know, 2 to 3 months, 6 months, 12 months, you start to look for managing that energy and getting the, you know, the opportunity to do the stuff that's important to you in your life over that longer period, rather than trying to have the perfect balance every day and every weekend, because I just think that's unrealistic.
Yep. Yeah. No, I get it. I think what's really important, going back to the, so, you know, talking about Steve Redgrave thing and the Matt Pinson, and I think you showed real humility, and for anyone, you know, for anyone in a situation where you've got someone that you hugely respect and almost there, you know, and don't take me wrong, because I know that you obviously, you know, you were there on merit and stuff. But when you've got someone at that level that's done so much, you show real humility. Look, guys, you're at your level. I might not be able to help you here. I want to learn from you. I know my stuff. And when these new people were coming in, and then that's when you start to develop with them. So it shows real humility. And I just want to commend you for that. I'm sure, I don't know if you realise at the time or if you've always been like that, but certainly it's a good, lesson.
You know, the easiest way of starting to get some conversations going at that point, because, you know, and I'd had various conversations with sort of supervisors and people who were helping me develop in that role in the past, in terms of, you know, just you know, think of someone who's done the rounds and has got a big career, you know, as a mid-20s, late-20s, you know, person who's just starting their career, you know, what actually have you got to offer them? You know, because if you can come up with something, great, but the chances are you haven't got anything directly to offer them. But what you have got is the opportunity to test out what you do know, to see what they think about it, as well as learning from them as well. So very, very much a case of a collaborative mindset rather than, it's all right, I've got a PhD, I've done some stuff, trust me, you're going to think I'm a legend.
Yeah, well, I listen, it's why you did 5 Olympics, mate, anyway, but certainly some brilliant stuff in there. So let's go on. So Steve Redgrave, Matt Pinson, benchmark for British rowing, absolutely phenomenal what they did. New people coming in and stuff, any athletes that stood out to you that you worked with that you can highlight, and also what was it such about them that was just inspired you and that was amazing? Because rowing is such a grueling sport. It takes such mindset and application, those tough times, to get over the line. You see them at the end of the boat, at the race, in their boat, like literally.
Yeah, they're spent.
They can't do anything else. They couldn't even breathe, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
So,
There was, you know, great people coming through. I had the chance to work pretty closely, you know, young coach at the time, first Olympics, Martin McElroy. He ended up coaching the men's eight to a gold medal in Sydney, and we worked a lot together. But that was the sort of lesser experienced end of the squad as well. Catherine Granger coming in for her first Olympics as well. So her first World Championships was the first one that I went to. So Catherine's coming on the scene as a young athlete coming out of university, you know, she was just a great person to work with, very open from the outset, very willing to learn, you know, with and from everyone around her. And that was the stuff that always impressed me about the people who were coming through, about the desire to collaborate, you know, the desire to say, who's around me? Who else do I need to be, you know, working really well with in order that I can achieve what I want to. So whether it was Martin as a coach, guys in the eight, whether it was Catherine in her crews, other coaches as well at the time, you know, they were looking to say, who else is around? What can I learn from them? How can they help me? How can they support me? And they had a thirst for adding to what was already very good in themselves, but they were building their confidence and again, humble enough to kind of get some help along the way to see if it could fast track them.
Granger's journey is amazing and one be great to hear of, because she got silver. Was it silver?
Then a gold, another silver. Yeah.
Then a gold, another silver. So I think you said about it's the journey. Sometimes
the medal is, you know, isn't necessarily, you know, the only thing to focus on, because there's very different versions of silver that exist.
Yeah. So with Catherine, which is fascinating, you know, you to get a silver, and it'd be good to see where she was at with that first silver, then another silver. And then you're thinking, so she got two silvers, and you're probably filling the gaps here. Where is it after the second silver, they were world champions?
Yeah, world champions for three consecutive years between the Olympics in the women's quad, and then got another silver in the Beijing Olympics, losing to the Chinese in the last 150.
So to lose there, and then you should have got a gold, and to come back and get gold 4 years later, to me, shows so inspiring and amazing mindset and ability. Share on that story, because that's fantastic.
I think it's quite interesting, because after the Beijing Olympics, what Catherine did do is that she took the next season when she decided she was going to come back and sort of go through to London. She took the next season in the single scull. And so she only had herself to focus on for that season. And I think that was a really important part of the kind of the resetting and getting ready to go again. Because she came back, had a relatively mixed season, but then did a typical Catherine kind of thing and had just a phenomenal World Championships. And she got a silver medal in the single scull at the World Championships in 2009, which is one of the greatest rows I've ever seen.
And out of form as well.
It was through the season. It was a bit up and down because she was kind of finding her way through, you know, competing in the single at that level. But then, you know, she knows how to raise her game and was quite brilliant. But in that season, her and I had spoken quite a lot about kind of falling back in love with rowing and just sort of moving the boat as fast as you can and sort of thinking about the experiences she'd had when she first got in a boat and it moved fast and kind of connecting her back with, you know, some of that stuff and really asking her why she does it and what she loves about it. And, you know, as well as being hugely competitive, there was a love of just, you know, that challenge of getting the hull moving and moving fast and having that sense of speed. So that was a really important kind of reset that we worked on.
And that's what I was going to say. Did you have to do a lot of work yourself? And is this where you really come into your own and these sort of moments where, you know what, actually, this is where psychology comes in, that you have to, you know,
I don't see it any different of earning your keep. But you know, it's looking for what's the value you can provide for the story that the person's currently in the middle of. So whether they're on a roll and flying, what's the story? How do you provide your value? You know, when things are kind of steady, what do you do? If things have kind of not gone to plan, what do you do? So for me, it's kind of looking at, you know, where can you keep the story going from whatever your emotions are about, you know, the current chapter you're reading or sort of that's rolling out in front of you. But certainly that was an interesting one. We'd obviously worked together for quite a few years at that point. So it was just an opportunity to chat a little bit more about, you know, Catherine, her history, you know, her track record, how she'd managed to do that across lots of different boat classes, you know, what were some of the characteristics that were consistently at the heart of that, because that was her and her character and her ambition and her generosity and humility and passion. Those things were all very present. So bringing them, you know, to life just for her in her own boat and reinforcing those kind of things to then connect back with, you know, how they were going to be ongoing characteristics, you know, through the remainder of the Olympics as well, that Olympic cycle as well.
With Catherine, it's amazing because obviously, so she had those silvers, and for you, what I'm getting, you're, you know, you're having to just adjust how you know, your role depending on if they're flying or if they're not doing as well. But with Catherine, it's a great learning curve for you, you know, in terms of, I suppose, and working with someone like that, where you've got the highs and the lows she's having.
Yeah, and also there's another bit of context which I think is important. So, you know, with rowing, you typically work. I was with a crew, so it would be Catherine as a member of the women's quad in 2000, or the women's pair in 2004, women's quad 2008, a double 2012, and then another double 2016. So there's always the coach involved as well as the other athletes. So you've always got that sense of what's the mission that the individual athletes are part of and what do they need to be doing and how can I help them play that, as well as helping the kind of collective mission be as clear as possible and the athletes and the coaches getting real clarity over their group dynamics, their picture of success, you know, making sure that the psychological glue for all of them is there, and then the individuals are absolutely ready to, you know, play their part and lead from their seat in the crew, as it were. So there was always that part of it, which makes it really enjoyable because you've got, you know, one-to-one conversations with her, but also in the context of how's the crew, what's the mission, you know, what's, you know, how am I helping her play her role with the other stuff we've been talking about collectively. And that gives the variety. And as part of the Olympic challenge as well, it's always a different challenge. It's not the same every Olympics. There's always a different challenge in there, which makes it great.
Yeah, and that's great, isn't it? Like, you've got, you know, let's say you're working with the quad. So you've got four there, and they've got the shared passion, that, you know, shared goal, look, we want to get gold. So there's a team element you're working on there. And this is probably relevant to your Planet K2 stuff and what you're doing with companies. Shared goal, right, that's it. But you've also got these individuals and they're at different stages or their mindsets in different places. So that's that can be a company now, you know. And that's,
and
that's
great.
And
different personalities too. Yeah. You know, and you want to celebrate the diversity and really benefit from that whilst also allowing everyone to be in a really strong position to bring the best of themselves to a, you know, a shared approach as well. So you're trying to get that, you're trying to get that brilliant collaboration from diversity as well as creating similarity and shared reference points, which become the reference point for belonging and togetherness. So you're trying to get, you're constantly trying to balance that stuff. But same within any commercial team or group where you're trying to make the whole greater than the sum of the parts. That's the aim. Is the shared purpose there? Is there absolute role clarity? Is there huge amounts of confidence in self, each other, and the unit as a whole? You know, take the time to work those things out rather than assuming that we're all experienced people. We've done similar stuff before. We don't need to talk about it that much.
Yeah, it's great. But I like the reference of football, people playing the right positions. You know, you want to stick a goalkeeper up front, goalkeeper, you know, goalkeeper's attributes and mindset different to the striker, what he needs to do. So,
and then fitting in with the team formation.
Yes.
That you want to play rather than, well, you know, I played in goal at another club.
Yeah.
I know how to do it. Well, you know, we've got some different philosophy in different ways here. So we want you to bring some of what you've learned, but also, how do you help us play the way we want to play?
Yeah. And that's great. And that's something that rowing is, you know, like you say, you've got different characters, shared purpose, different characters, team ethic, but individually need to work with. I think it's so relevant to everything
well as different
now.
Different roles in the boat. So even though they all look like they're doing the same thing, that, you know, there is subtle difference between the person sitting in the stroke seat and the people in the engine room, the bow, you know, there's all the different qualities that, you know, each person needs to think about. How do I become 100% of my 25% of the boat, or whatever percentage it is, depending upon how many of them in there.
And I love it, Chris. It's just, you know, hearing you talk, it's just the way it just resonates into life and everything. You know, it's funny, isn't it? This, you're talking about four people in a rowing boat at Olympic level, but it's so relevant to things that we, you know, all of the diversity of it all and stuff. So, you know, it's great.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's the nice bit for us about it is human performance. So, you know, whether you're trying to move a bit of carbon fiber backwards as quickly as possible over 2,000 meters of water, or whether you're sort of trying to create some new product which is going to go to market, or you're sort of looking at keeping an organization financially consistent and safe and legal, you know, it's human performance.
Yeah, definitely. So, Catherine Grangeup, so the third silver going into London, it's London, London after me. What was that fascinating? I mean, that's, I just look at it and I think, you know what, I tip my hat. Phenomenal, you know, three silvers, should have had the gold on the third one in terms of form of where they were at and didn't get it. To come back and win the gold eventually, just, that's amazing, you know. I mean, so what can you share around that four years?
One of the benefits also of the Olympic cycles and the opportunity for it not to be the same, and actually the fact that Anna Watkins and Catherine went into London together in a double. So they rode first in 2010, and you can hear them talk about the fact when they first got in a boat, it just kind of, it clicked, and they knew it was going to be fast. So as soon as you've got that, you've now got a situation where Anna, having had a bronze medal in the double at Beijing, Catherine having had her silver, they are now starting to look forward, being excited about what they might do together, rather than looking back, thinking about, we have to erase this or build on this.
Yeah,
you know, so it's that sense of balancing. How do you use the past to inspire and give you a reason? But then how do you use the opportunity to look forward to know that you can write a different chapter, which is going to define you in a different way, or it's going to update stuff? And so and from a personality point of view, you know, that was where they had a really good blend of being able to kind of be inspired and looking forward whilst also being compassionate and recognizing, you know, some of what had gone before, but knowing that wasn't going to define either or both of them in any way. So there's kind of some really nice stuff there about how do you go again, what do you get curious about,
yeah,
a new opportunity,
yeah,
rather than, you know, and create something that is going to be a value rather than erase a previous negative.
Yeah, but Chris, you know what, I think this is, you know, something which fascinates me of what you just said there, and it's actually relevant to anyone trying to succeed in life or whatever. These two, So you've got the past, the present, the future. Dealing with those three things, is that's life. And what I mean by that is, look at the past. How to deal with the past. Look at the past for what it was. It was the past. How can you learn from it? Celebrate your successes. Learn from your past failures. Not dwell on it too much. So there's the lessons there. You can only deal with what you're in the current present. So what's happened in the past or what you want to do in the future is irrelevant. What you do in the current moment is so important. And you know, we spoke about it earlier in the podcast where you were just saying about being in the moment and dealing with that there and then being so important. Yeah. That's all you can actually deal with. So there's that. So it's being focused on your present, whatever is required in that current situation, that current time is the only thing that you can affect performance is the present time. But then it's having the future, looking into the future and looking at it with positivity and what you can achieve and not being negative and worrying what if, just having that focus on the future that it's going to be a positive outcome. So almost what you're describing here with Catherine and her partner in the boat.
And Anna.
And Anna, actually, it embellishes life, without getting too deep on this, isn't it? Because it's how to deal with the past, how to focus on the present and how to look forward into the future.
Yeah, and all of us probably have a bias as to which one of those three is most sort of, you know, comes most naturally to us in terms of influencing our thinking. You know, so some of us are more geared towards, you know, using the past as a foundation block to move from. Others maybe a little bit more geared towards imagining the future and possibilities. Other people are sort of, you know, more naturally wired to be in the moment and look at how things go. But what I'd say for the important stuff that we're talking about here is that, you know, we want to look at how do we make each of those things as helpful as possible. So whether I've got, you know, a bias for one or the other, you know, or whichever of the three, how do I use the past in the most helpful way? How do I use the present in the most helpful way? And how do I use the possibility of the future in the most helpful way? Because there are stories where we can get unhelpful versions.
Yeah.
So I can use the past in an unhelpful way to hold me back. I can unhelpfully fixate in the present moment and get so paralyzed by the in the moment analysis that it doesn't free me up. And I can certainly be sort of having an unhelpful version of the future, which is really, setting enormous expectations and goals for myself, which, you know, just feel far too, you know, big and unachievable, than then being dissatisfied when I never live up to those expectations I have for myself. So we've got, you know, and I say to everyone, start to understand your personality and where the bias is and see how skillful you become at making that bias as helpful as possible, as often as possible. And then when can you bring in some of the other non-preferred ways of thinking to add even more help to your natural preference? And that's where we kind of get the three working together.
So would you say then the key to this, because I'm just trying to think practical now for anyone listening.
Yeah.
Is it to be very focused on using the past in the right way? Or is it asking yourself questions of what you want to achieve? So the present's important. How would any practical things around that?
Yeah. I think if you want a practical recommendation, there's an excellent book called The Present by a guy called Dr. Spencer Johnson, which talks about.
Good book.
Yeah. The past is history. The future is a mystery. The present is a gift, the present is an opportunity. So that there's some good stuff in there which kind of gets into the practicality. But yeah, for me, in terms of have you taken the time to look at the past and recognize the consistent strengths and qualities and the reasons why you have had the degree of success that you have? Because just remember, success and failure is a kind of is on a scale. It's not an all or nothing thing. But what tends to happen with the past is we'll look back and think about where we weren't fully successful and we'll just define that as failure and then be sort of disappointed by it, rather than saying, what are the common ingredients of the level of success I have got to, as well as what's the learning in terms of how I want to keep adding to that level of success to become, you know, more consistent at a higher level. So, you know, so you use the past helpfully to provide you with knowledge as to how you might move forward and what you want to focus on now. And also use that to give you a really good challenge of seeing how effectively you can position your targets in the future to feel realistic and challenging and know that they are a good build on what you've achieved in the past. So there's a real sense of practical progress. And I talk to people about, you know, goals stuff, about gold, silver, bronze goals for the future. Gold is if you blow the, you know, blow the doors off every day and you perform to the best of your ability, and you know, what could gold standard of an outcome look like? Silver, what would you be really proud of that's going to deliver something that you know is representative of you? And bronze is, what's the minimum achievement you believe you should be able to deliver based upon track record and what you expect of yourself? So, and you can choose where to start with setting those. Some people start with bronze and go up. Some people start with gold and come down. Some people start with silver and work out what the nuances are. But that stuff works really
well. Love that. What I'd like to know is, you know, you outlined obviously gold being, you know, if you went hell for leather, amazing, and you delivered that. How should someone practically think about goal setting? We should have one of each. How is it in real life terms?
Yeah, so in real life terms, they can be focused on sort of, you know, an outcome goal and where you want to end up. So there might be sort of, you know, an end point of, you know, well, if everything goes really, really well and sort of, you know, every day is amazing, or just, you know, if it's a weight loss goal, so, you know, over a 6-week period, just, you know, how much weight loss do I think is achievable if I stick with everything really well, I use the support really well? What is achievable at the top end? Middle ground is, you know, what do I think is going to be realistic? What will I be really satisfied with? And I'll kind of get a good sense of pride. And then bronze is, what's the bare minimum that I'd expect that, you know, given what I've done in the past, given what I'm aiming for here, what's the minimum I should expect? And, you know, so it's end point goals, but it might be about, you know, similarly bringing in a new habit and sort of making it fully embedded, or sort of, you know, something that's sort of three times a week and once a week. But you just decide, where do you want to start? Are you someone who likes to avoid failure? If so, I'd recommend start with bronze and then work upwards. Or else, are you someone who's inspired by sort of, you know, setting new standards for yourself? If so, start with the gold. Equally, if you're someone who sort of has got a pretty good steady track record, start with the silver and work out how much the sort of difference is either side of that as well. But the big thing is too much goal setting is very black or white. You either do it or you don't. Mm-hmm. This gives you the chance to kind of play with the reality that life isn't always straightforward of hitting a goal, yes or no.
Of course, and then they'll see action. You need action that as well.
And you keep reviewing all the way along the line. 100%. Where am I doing? What am I online for? Because any of them is an achievement, you know. So keep pitching to deliver, you know, any one of them. And then if you can upgrade, fantastic. If you're already on gold, see how long you can keep that progress going to that level for. But it just gives you more feedback to play with.
Yeah, definitely. That's fantastic. And how you've explained that. But the sort of flip side of that, and I just want to sort of challenge goal setting, and you mentioned weight loss, and I referenced the gym. So for me, kind of come here and go, right, what an extreme change, you know? So they're going to be perfect. The lifestyle is going to be perfect. You know, no sugar, water only. All of this is perfect if you outline a perfect diet. Now, that's fine. You will definitely get a result. The outcome will definitely be there. But then it's the strategy after that. So I suppose with goal setting, and you've outlined it a little bit in terms of the goal setting, bronze, silver, gold depends on, put them all down, gold, silver, bronze, goals. Depends on then on the person, managing expectations, what that characteristic's like. But I suppose the slight downside is someone who thinks, oh, I'm just going to do gold because that's what it is. But if they've not got the mental capabilities to deal with that after, and the strategy after that, and I reference weight loss, you can go really extreme, get a change, 12 weeks, brilliant. But what are you doing after that? You've hit your goal. So it's like sometimes a bit of a disconnect and they go back to the old ways.
There's some interesting stuff there. First is, you know, perfect is a verb, not a noun. So there's no such thing as a perfect diet. And so anyone who's sort of aiming for perfect is a doing word. It's you seek to perfect something. So it's an ongoing challenge rather than, you know, perfect is not a noun. So that's really important. The other thing that I talk to people a lot about there is sort of, look, you know, if a habit is embedded, what's your personal best now in terms of consecutive days of delivering at a level that you're really satisfied with? So let's say you manage 12 days where you're really satisfied, but on the 13th day, unlucky for some, you just sort of drop off a little bit. So you've now got a personal best of 12 days of really good level habit execution. Okay, so 13 you drop off, you start again. Can you extend your personal best? So I think as long as there's some curiosity to kind of keep playing, as well as some self-compassion to realize that, do you know what, I can drop off a little bit, but it doesn't undo all of the work that's gone before. It just means that I've worked out something about my limits and I can seek to go again, see if I can extend it. So where there's a curiosity to play with, how do I keep things going? How do I, you know, when I'm traveling, how do I keep the habit going? When I haven't got my normal support structure around me, how do I keep the habit going? You just do stuff like that to kind of, you know, accept the reality that, you know, life is not absolutely a straight line all the time, every day, and there's going to be differences, and you learn how to keep the habit going and you find out how important it is to you. But also, like with athletes, you know, sometimes they'll have an active recovery day. So in the Tour de France, when the guys have a rest day, they're still on the bike. They're going to have a spin. Mm. So, you know, for us with habits, you know, active recovery, sometimes, you know, don't worry about keeping it going at absolutely the 100% level all the time. Back off a little bit. Give yourself a bit of recovery that you're still doing it to an extent, but start playing with how much you want to do it. So, you know, there's various ways in which you can stay in control of, you know, the objective rather than having it control you.
Yeah, brilliant, mate. That's great. So just a couple of things we'll ask around the Olympics and then want to move on to something else. What top things you've learned from the Olympics and the top athletes?
I think the best athletes I know, there's a huge amount of the sort of self-awareness. They really get themselves, they understand themselves, and they're confident enough to build a recipe around what they know about themselves. So that they don't spend too much time trying to be like other people. They actually really understand what makes them tick, and they're able to sort of go, right, how do I sort of build on that? How do I embrace that? How do I make that work for me? And then how do I add to it? So there's a real sense of, you know, understanding self and then developing self based around what you know to be true. So that's really good. And I guess, you know, one of the six winning mindset sort of characteristics that I often talk about is that, you know, they have a great ability to use the support team around them. You know, that, you know, like we've talked about, there is that desire to kind of, who can help me? I've got a thirst to develop. I know I can't do it all on my own. So, you know, let's really effectively use other people. So they're very good at using the support, but holding themselves accountable to doing great stuff as well. So I think those couple of characteristics are particularly key.
Yeah, so support and self-awareness. And I think self-awareness, you know, self-awareness is something that's really important. And you've probably seen it in top athletes. I mean, you know, obviously coming from a football background, and, you know, I always try and resonate some of that when I'm talking to clients. The self-awareness, being aware of where you may be in areas you need to improve, being honest to yourself of those areas you need to improve, what's realistically you can achieve. Yeah. And in self-awareness, it all comes back to self-awareness. So I think, you know, hearing you say that from what you've learned from the best is brilliant.
And they have the awareness of what's good about them, which is the key thing. You know, they're kind of willing to accept that, look, these things are good about me, as well as here's some stuff I know that I want to keep working on. So it's that balance of both.
Yeah, and another thing is as well, and we spoke a little bit earlier in the podcast, you know, and where I commented on your humility and your the way you come across, you know, so someone that you've been in psychology in the top level, you obviously you've grown and developed, and the way you are now and the conversation, the short conversations we've had, and I see you, and you mentioned about how you were willing to learn from them. I think these athletes have the same as well, have that same mindset as well. And I think there's a real good take home point to everyone that, look, you know, yes, you want to be the best, but it doesn't matter if you're not the best, get someone around you that you can maybe get better with. And that's fine, you know, get a team around you, which is the other thing you mentioned here, the support. These best athletes have support around them and recognize that. So I think that, you know, that sort of grounding, that humility, that compassion is hugely important in humanity.
Well, it is from, mate, a confidence, you know, from a self-confidence point of view, you know, you do ultimately end up being confident enough to be yourself. That's something I've said to people over the years. You know, going into the Olympics, you want to get to the point where you know that by being yourself, it's going to be good enough. So are you confident enough to be yourself when the pressure's on? So you've got to, you know, there's a there was a great video back from the 2000 Olympics of Cathy Freeman talking about when she won her gold medal representing Australia, having lit the torch, you know, and she said in her warm-up, she used the phrase, do what I know. So that phrase, do what I know, just as you're warming up for your Olympic final, when the eyes of Australia are on you expecting you to deliver a gold medal, that's really, really powerful self-talk. But unless you've done the due diligence to work out
what
the value is of doing what you know, and what is it that I know, and what am I good at, it's just hollow words. But with that self-awareness and self-acceptance, it becomes incredibly sort of freeing and liberating.
Yeah, fantastic. And it's doing the work, isn't it? Yeah. I have a quote, you know, so in my mind is like, you know, it's the work that people don't see, which is reflective for the work they do see. You know, it's that behind the scenes, that practice, that day in stuff, that work behind the scenes, the hard work of these top athletes that people don't see, which allows people like the Cathy Freemans to be on the start line doing her thing, going, do what you know.
Yeah, with huge confidence to be yourself, you know, and that's what you're ultimately looking for in terms of that phenomenal awareness and compassion.
Anything else around the Olympic sports scene and athletes that you've seen that's relevant to, you know, obviously sharing this attributes or qualities or standout things that, like, you know, wow, that was like that's a light bulb moment for me, or that's powerful.
But I don't know about light bulb moments, but I think that point you mentioned about the, you know, the work that goes on in the background, just the ability to do the graft and sort of not cut corners and sort of, you know, really stick with the monotony of training, but still find value from it. And there's a bunch of stuff in everyday life that, you know, we all, you know, not every moment at work is inspiring and uplifting and game changing, you know, and actually that just that ability for the athletes to know that they're in it for the long run. There's a lot of stuff that they're going to have to do that isn't particularly exciting, but it's essential. But then, you know, that's building the foundation from which the exciting stuff is going to happen. And I think that trade-off has been really interesting, just sort of seeing who's able to manage that, and, you know, and it's not always easy, but they know the improvement is coming.
Yeah, it's huge. And I think for me, it's like, you know, something which, you know, to lead on from that really is it's sort of motivation, because everyone would go, yeah, you know, true motivation comes from within, motivation to go and do something. You know, I know it can be, you know, the quotes out there or whatever it may be. But to me, and this is where the top athletes are in them, and you just mentioned the point, we don't always want to feel like we're going to do something. So true motivation just comes in having principles that you hold dear to you, that is Chris Shambrook, that's Ollie Berkwedz, that's Cathy Freeman, that's Matthew Pinson, for example, you know? And what I mean by that is, like, so me, I don't always want to go and train in the gym. I don't always want to eat well, but I just know the lifestyle is what I'm about. It's important to me how I go about my daily life, what's my values and things. So even when I don't want to do it and I don't want to train, they're my values. So I'll make a way to go and do it, because I know that is doing the benefit for me. It's for the benefit, it's for the greater good. So that's what these athletes have. I just want to reinforce that point. They have this motivation when they haven't got the motivation.
Yeah, it's a sort of fine line for them to tread as well, because obviously in that case you're handing your identity over to your performance and your sport and your success. You know, I am an international athlete, and therefore this is what I do, you know, so that they, but when they stop being an athlete, then that opens themselves up to the question of, well, who am I now? So that's where you see a lot of transition stuff taking place. So it's really transition challenges and sort of, you know, people sort of coming out and sort of not having such direction, such sort of goal-driven stuff, such reinforcement. And that's where, you know, become someone, you know, I am an exerciser. I am someone who looks after myself. You know, I am someone who's compassionate to self and others. You know, use those kind of phrases, but also I think it's be aware of checking in with that stuff from time to time and saying, you know, is that still right for me? Is that still something that's important? What else is on the horizon that's important to me? Keep updating it and keep it relevant as life develops and as you develop.
Yeah, and for people listening, they're not Olympic athletes. They're just, you know, everyday business people, people going about their day-to-day lives. But what's good is that it's just saying, look, and what you said here is, it's fine, you know, you're not going to be motivated, but, you know, and they, what I mean by that is they don't have the identity of an athlete. So these top athletes have their Olympic world stage performers, and then their other persona when they're not doing that,
obviously that's a challenge they have to deal with, because everyday people don't have that. They're not world-class athletes, but to let them know, look, it's okay. What's have just that motivation that you're not always going to feel like it, and draw on that, you know, if you're doing the right things for the benefit of you, whatever that may be, that's motivation enough.
Yeah.
Even if you don't feel like it.
Yeah. And motivation isn't a single level construct. It is something that ebbs and flows in all of us every day. You know, if we look at self-determination theory, where our sense of control, choice, autonomy changes, that has an impact upon our motivation. Where our confidence and competence changes, that has an impact upon our motivation. When our sense of being connected to other people or part of something, where that changes, motivation goes up and down. So we've got these various ingredients that, you know, are on the dashboard of motivation, sort of change a little every day. So we've still got an overall quality of motivation, but it's not, you know, the Olympic athletes haven't got stellar knocking it out of the park, run through brick walls motivation every single day. But they've got some principles they can come back to, which means that even when they're not feeling that motivated, they still know, how do I do a good day? How do I get good quality out of today? How do I build some more control, some more confidence, some more connectedness to keep the motivation from dropping too far? So they're probably, you know, they're pretty good at not letting it drop too far rather than having it really high all the time.
Yeah. And then when they're struggling, they get Chris Shambrick in and they can do the psychology side of it.
but again, that for me was always one of the big things is, you know, psychology isn't about waiting till you're struggling. It's about getting on the front foot and making sure that, you know, you're doing the good stuff. Like with fitness, you don't wait to get unfit before you go, well, some people do, but you try and keep it ticking over at a decent level. And that should be, you know, mindset as well.
Of course it is, and that's great, and that can only have made you better, Chris, that you've dealt with people who are at the top to keep them at the top, people who need to get them, really pull them up. So for you, it's only enhanced your craft over the years, seeing people at the different stages they're at with their performance.
It's been a really enjoyable challenge to sort of say, how do we add value here to people who are already very good at what they do? You know, that mindset for me that, you know, I'm not hanging around till they have a crisis.
Yeah.
Before I step in, you know, with superhero outfit on, because I just think that's, you know, that's more about you than it is about them. And then, but you know, how do I keep supporting people who are already very good? And is there anything I've got to add value?
Yeah, and I think the big thing, just to summarise on this last bit, what we've just covered here, and we've said it quite a bit in the podcast, is questioning, isn't it? So if you're in a group environment, questioning, asking questions of each other, personally asking questions, and then coming up with answers. Obviously, depend on the person if they want to come up with the answer themselves or you steer them to it. So I think, questioning, you've mentioned it a few times, is certainly very important.
Yeah. And being confident to keep asking similar questions to sort of update the answers so that you've got the most relevant recent information that's forming your attitudes, that's therefore driving your behaviours and the choices that you're making as well. So it's, you know, you don't have to keep finding loads and loads of different questions. It's the discipline of similar questions, right? What's the answer now? What does that tell us? You know, what do we do next?
Yeah, brilliant. So who are your personal heroes, Chris, and why do you hold them in such high regard?
Heroes, interesting one. Not sure. I guess I'd probably reframe that and sort of say who's someone that I've had a huge amount of respect for and sort of, so Roger Federer for me is just an absolute sort of legend in terms of self-awareness, self-management, ability to stay at the top. You look at his track record over all the years of tennis that he's been playing, the beauty and the grace with which he plays and the sort of overall approach that he takes to looking after himself and staying fit, you know, now that he's sort of, you know, been playing for quite a while. I just think he's absolutely exemplary. And, you know, if I had the chance to sit down and chat with him and sort of pick his brain, that would be fantastic. So I guess people who I'd want to sort of pick their brain probably start moving into hero status for me. And Roger Federer would certainly be someone in that sense. And I guess from a really recent sort of perspective, Kipchoge's, you know, sub 2-hour marathon at the weekend, not necessarily a hero, but someone who I'd want to, you know, you just listen to some of the stuff that he talks about, some of the sort of energy he's got psychologically, as well as his immense physiology, you know, that people like that who are willing to test themselves out to find out what can be done, just remarkable.
Yeah. Fantastic. What are the three mindset attributes, the key? So obviously, because you've dealt with so many people across sports and everything else. What are the three best mindset attributes that you would say you've seen or a key when you're analysing things?
So I guess, you know, I've tried to boil them down into different kind of ways of putting these in front of people, but sort of certainly three of several that are always important. That ability to the 100% mentality. So what version of me am I today, and I'm going to get 100% out of that. That for me is really important, where you're not expecting to be 100% at your best every day, but whatever version of yourself that you are, you're going to get 100% out of it and enjoy seeing what you can do with that. I think the other one that I stick alongside that is the right now focus. You know, I'm going to be really good at getting in the moment and focusing on the right thing. And I'm going to enjoy working out what the right thing is and then seeing how effectively I can, you know, immerse myself in the here and now. So when you've got 100% mentality, you're in the here and now, then that's really important. And I guess the other bit there that sits alongside that for me is just that self-acceptance, you know, I've got an attitude that, you know, I'm aware of what I've got. I know my strengths. I know the stuff I'm proud that I'm me, that I possess, and I'm doing everything in the right now with 100% full of that self-acceptance that, you know, well, this is what I've got. I like it. I'm going to use it. Stay in the moment, get everything out of myself that I can. And you know, that's really helpful for those moments that matter, in the knowledge that, you know, people have always got a desire to grow and improve. So in 3 weeks' time, my recipe will be slightly different. But, you know, that just the ability to step into the moment with the clarity of the 100% right now and self-acceptance, for me, those are really, really powerful.
Yeah, amazing. Absolutely amazing. So I like asking this question, and it fascinates me because... So I'll ask the question in the context. So what advice would you give to the younger Chris, say 10 years ago, 15 years ago? And the reason I like asking it is because perspective and hindsight and failures and learning and along the way shapes us. And if we look back, we could certainly help that younger version of ourselves. So what advice would you give to that, Chris?
The advice I would give was no one else in the room is concerned about the stuff that you know and that you have a passion for. So it's your job to voice what you know about the topic that you're passionate about. It doesn't mean that you're going to have to be accepted, but it's your job to help other people know what you know so that decisions can be made fully informed about the stuff that is your expertise. So speak up, share your knowledge, be brave, but don't, you know, but be ready to be rejected, but know that your voice has been heard and put forward. That for me would be, if I'd have got that concept earlier, that would have been much more of a game changer. You know, far too earlier on, far too much waiting for permission, hoping that people had the same passion that I did for the topic. But actually, you know, my job is to put that forward. So that for me would be the advice to my younger self.
Yeah, and sure, now you're passing on to people, which is great. Great words. Any words or quotes you live by, Chris?
Words or quotes?
Because there's been some serious knowledge bombs dropped today. There has been some golden nuggets in there, and I could probably go back through the podcast, and it's probably going to be 10. But yeah, any words or quotes you live by?
Not necessarily that I live by, but lots that I remember and that I use because they kind of they've got great messages behind them. John Wooden, basketball coach from years ago in America, sort of had a great career, coached loads of people, loads of successful NCAA titles. Look up John Wooden. He's got some great sort of quotes as well. But one of them that I've always liked from is don't judge yourself by what you've achieved, but by what you should have achieved with your potential. And that's a really nice one that kind of keeps you honest to recognize the stuff that's been good and what you have done in the past, but have a look at, well, you know, well, what is my potential and how close to that have I got? And that's a particularly thought provoking one as well. I think there's another one of his. That's kind of gets in the same line, which is it's what you know after you think it's what you learn after you think you know it all that really counts.
Yeah, really good.
Yeah.
Love that one, mate. That's great. Yeah, that's great. Chris, absolutely amazing catch up today. And thank you so much for your time.
My pleasure.
Now, people are going to want to connect with you. I know you're LinkedIn. So, a couple of things. How could people connect with you? How could they find out more about you? Obviously, I will leave it's all in the show notes.
Yeah.
Obviously,
yeah.
Performance from Planet K2.
Yeah.
And also, what things you've got going on? Because I know you're writing a book.
Yeah. Yeah.
Is that allowed to? Are we allowed
to share
that?
Yeah. Okay. That'll put a bit more pressure on me to get it finished.
Yes, mate. I know. Because we obviously, I know that's happening. And I'm going to be certainly getting a copy of that. So, yeah, what's got going on? Where people can find you?
Well, as you mentioned, the performance room is probably the easiest place. So the performanceroom.co.uk, that's the kind of Planet K2 sharing of performance information openly to the world. So, you know, get yourself on there, free sign up. There's loads of information. You don't even, you know, yeah, loads of stuff you can get in there for free. So please do get that. And there's sort of contacts through to all of us at Planet K2 via the performance room. But yeah, LinkedIn, Twitter, sort of at Chris Shambrook, and you know, regularly on LinkedIn sharing stuff as well, and so that's kind of the way to get hold of me and get in touch. The book,
share anything?
Yeah,
can you share anything?
it's going to be some of the stuff we've talked about, but I want to sort of put some stuff out there that helps people really understand this 100% mentality. And what does that mean? But what's the groundwork that you've got to put in place so that you can actually enjoy living that 100% mentality and benefiting from it? Because I think it's one that allows us to step into a place of making the most of ourselves rather than a lot of the other self-help stuff that's out there, which is about telling us that we need to be more like other people rather than more like ourselves.
Yeah, and that's so practical. So, mate, I can't wait for that book to come out. And when is it, next year, when you're looking at releasing it?
Yeah, it'll be, if I can get it out just ahead of the Olympics, I think that'll be good timing.
Yeah, great timing. Chris, listen, thanks so much for your time today. It's been an absolute pleasure catching up with you, mate. And, you know, great guy, doing amazing things. And I know the value people have got from this podcast today. So thanks for your time.
Absolute pleasure. And, you know, keep in touch and let's see where all of the application of this stuff takes us.
Exactly, mate. Definitely. Thanks, Chris.
Cheers. All the best.
Cheers, mate.
What a great podcast there with Chris. And he's such a knowledgeable, intelligent, and great guy. And I think it was the longest podcast episode I've had so far. But sometimes when so much value and knowledge is being shared to people listening, you just can't shorten it. And that's certainly the case with Chris. The fact he's seen 5 Olympic cycles at, you know, top level, his knowledge around psychology, mindset and performance is so valuable, and it's so relevant to everyone in any walk of life, any industry. And I think he made so many good take-home points, and it's hard to just pick out a few, but I think about living in the present, looking at the past and the future, having a bronze, silver, gold medal standard for goal setting, and the focus he placed on collaboration, working as a team, but also looking at your individual performance and how that can affect just you and the team as well. And I just think, yeah, some great messages left there. If you enjoyed the episode, then I'd love to hear from you. Please drop me a message on any of the platforms or on LinkedIn, Oliver Berquez. If you enjoyed the episode, please, please share it with anyone you know who might get value. And if you listen to it on Apple iTunes, then please leave us a 5-star review, as it will help to reach more people. Once again, thank you for listening, and I hope you got value from the episode.